Case number 17-6032, Benny Hodge versus Scott Jordan. Oral argument not to exceed 30 minutes per side. Mr. Burke for the appellant.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It please the court. My name is Dennis Burke on behalf of Benny Hodge. And today I am going to, there are three arguments that are raised in the brief, but I'm going to focus on the ineffective assistance of trial counsel in the penalty phase of the trial, which I believe is claim two, or it's argument one, I think in the principal brief. So this is a case where Benny Hodge had a trial, was sentenced to death, but the jury did not hear any mitigating evidence when it was deciding whether or not to sentence him to death. The state court actually has already determined that the trial counsel was deficient in his failure to investigate and present mitigating evidence. And as well, the state conceded that trial counsel was, his performance was deficient. So the focus of this will be on the penalty phase, or I'm sorry, on the prejudice part of the Strickland v. Washington analysis. What the jury did not hear at Benny's trial is that he had a lifelong, or starting from in utero through his childhood, a most severe physical and emotional abuse suffered at the hands of his, or a series of stepfathers, and neglect, or at least abandonment by his mother. And what the jury also didn't hear was that this evidence, or I'm sorry, that this trauma that he experienced had an impact upon the development of his brain, such that Benny never developed a, as an adult, he never learned to regulate his feelings. Did I hear a question, or am I getting feedback?
I have a question. Did your client refuse his lawyer's attempts to get some sort of a psychologist or some person of this nature to question him? There's something in the record about that.
Right. And the answer to that, Your Honor, is that no, he did not. So there was testimony at the by the trial attorney that he said from the beginning, I wanted Benny to be evaluated for purposes of the defense, and he declined or refused. But in fact, the trial court made no finding that there was a refusal on Benny's part to see the to consult with a or I'm sorry to be evaluated by a psychological expert. And while I'm at it, I think it's important also that the warden's brief stated that Benny had told him, even 10 years later, told his expert that he would not have talked with anyone about his childhood. And in fact, that's not the case. What he actually said, and this is through the testimony of the expert, is that he would not have testified. He thinks he probably wouldn't have testified at trial, which is much different from actually talking with his defense counsel, who, if they had developed a relationship with him, be it with a mitigation specialist or the attorneys themselves, and collected the records and interviewed family members and consulted with an expert, none of those things which were done, then regardless of whether Benny wanted to testify, then that mitigation still would have been presented at the penalty phase of the trial if counsel had been, or if counsel had not been deficient in
Mr. Burke,
his efforts.
Mr. Burke.
Yes.
Mr. Burke, my question is, I understand from the record, see if I'm correct, that there was a deal between the prosecution and defense counsel with respect to what would be presented at the penalty phase? Am I right about that?
No, it wasn't a deal at all. There are a couple of things that need to be.
Is there anything that appeared to be in the briefing that there was a deal?
There was an agreement at the time.
A deal and an agreement. Okay, there was an agreement.
There was an agreement where they agreed on a two-sentence statement that would be said to the jury in lieu of mitigation, which was that Benny came from had a loving family and he worked in Tennessee. And that was the extent of the evidence that came in at the penalty phase of the trial. Of course, what's important to note is that was done at a time when trial counsel was incapable of putting on mitigation evidence if he wanted to, because because trial counsel had done zero, and I stress zero, investigation for purposes of mitigation. He did not collect records. He did not interview any witnesses. He did not consult experts. He did nothing. And that is actually what the finding was of the state court as well. So by the time
an admission that he hadn't done any of that, right? So as well as
testimony
on the prejudice.
Correct.
Right. I mean, you have the state court finding that counsel was ineffective. It's really just a matter of prejudice.
That is correct.
I want to ask you, because the testimony regarding brain development,
mm-hmm.
witness gave you that?
That was Dr. Kaplan, who is a psychologist, and he testified regarding the impact that the childhood trauma would have upon Benny's brain as far as his development, that it would stunt his emotional development, and that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, which has a number of other aspects to it, including an inability to control his anger, control his impulses, to deal with problem solving.
So just to move on, we would have to find that the state court's application of Supreme Court law was unreasonable. So tell us why that's the case.
Okay. So the Kentucky Supreme Court ruling was both contrary to and an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. So as far as the contrary to standard goes, what the trial court found is that the mitigation evidence that came in at the post-conviction proceeding revealed and I'm quoting, most severe and unimaginable level of physical and mental abuse. And regardless of that, the Kentucky Supreme Court found that that would not rise to the level of prejudice, which would be a single juror who would find a reasonable probability that a single juror would have decided that based on that evidence, that it would have limited Benny's moral culpability such that he would not be sentenced to death. The Kentucky Supreme Court found that regardless of the most severe and unimaginable level of physical and mental abuse, the only way that would have an impact would be if it had a nexus or a connection, explained the crime, provided the jury with a rationale for the crime that he committed. And that finding by the court is contrary to clearly established federal law, in particular Tenard v. Dredke and also Smith v. Texas. And specifically in Smith v. Texas, the court found, addressing childhood abuse, found that it was contrary to Supreme Court precedent to require a nexus between the mitigation evidence and the crime. And so what happened here, and so there's some discussion that the Commonwealth talks about, well, they were simply, the court was simply weighing what their, the totality of the evidence, that they weren't refusing to consider the childhood evidence. They were, unless it had a nexus to the crime.
Counsel, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I have a question. what's your best case for showing a clearly established federal law there? Okay. That the failure to put this into evidence is a violation of clearly established federal law.
What's
the best case?
The best case, Your Honor, is Smith v. Texas.
Okay.
Where the court, again, the Supreme Court directly addressed the question of whether or not there is allowed to be a requirement of a nexus. And here's how we know that the Kentucky Supreme Court applied a nexus. Because again, they said it is a most severe and unimaginable level of physical abuse. And it's still, despite this most severe, it still did not matter for purposes of whether or not it would change a single juror to decide that it was not sentenced Benny to death, unless there was a nexus. And so the question to be is, well, what could change? What would change the Kentucky Supreme Court's mind? And the answer is there nothing unless there was a nexus. The only possible thing that could allow the Kentucky Supreme Court, where they would consider and give effect to the childhood abuse, is if there was a nexus between the abuse and the crime. And we know that because they already found that it was most severe and unimaginable. So how could it be any worse? They already found it was the most severe. And so what they have done is exactly what the United States Supreme Court has said they cannot do. They cannot require a nexus between the crime and the mitigation evidence. And by doing that, they established a standard that required Benny to meet that was greater than the standard required by the United States Supreme Court. And that is contrary to clearly established federal law that requires this court to grant habeas relief and order a new sentencing trial. So that's the first clause of 2254 D1, but it was also an unreasonable.
I'm sorry, counsel, I'm sure I really should know this, but is the case that you're focused on, does it actually say what kind of words does it say with respect to that nexus? Direct nexus? Because the weighing naturally is a weighing of the severity of the treatment and the behavior that causes this to be a death eligible spec kind of thing. So there is a natural weighing, I should think. And that's why we take mitigation and look at it as compared to aggravating.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. There's,
so
there's
there has to, a nexus has to be lawful. It may, no. I don't know what, well, give me a second to finish.
Okay.
I think that there is a natural drawing of so the nexus prohibition has to be something very specific and direct. And I ask your help on that. What is that?
Okay, so let me, and I'll quote you because I have the opinion right here.
That would be good.
The state court held that the petitioner had offered, quote, no evidence of any link or nexus between his troubled childhood and this capital murder. And then went on to say that we have already found that that a jury must be allowed the opportunity to consider Penry evidence, even if the defendant cannot establish a nexus to the crime. And of course, Penry evidence means mitigating evidence, where Penry said, the court must allow a wide variety of mitigating evidence. So
in that case, was the question whether the jury could hear it?
Yes, that went to a jury like instruction where the court refused to give a jury instruction so that they could give effect to that mitigation evidence. And then the court relied also upon Tenard v. Dredge, where the Supreme Court had said that you cannot require the jury, again, to find a nexus between the crime and the whatever the mitigating evidence is.
Cannot require the jury. Is that something different than your presenting to us today?
It isn't. And here's why. Because again, what the Kentucky Supreme Court has done is they have required a nexus. And we know they required a nexus, as I've said before, because they already found that the child abuse, the physical and emotional child abuse that he suffered was quote unquote, most severe and unimaginable level of physical and emotional abuse. So it cannot be that there could be more childhood abuse that then the Supreme Court would say, okay, that's enough that it rises to level, because it's already the most severe. And what the Supreme Court has said, one, is that the jury is required or should be allowed to consider all a huge range, including childhood abuse, number one. And number two, that a fact finder cannot, or a court cannot, refuse to consider and give effect to mitigation or a type of mitigation just because there is not a nexus or a link between the crime and the mitigation, which is exactly what the Kentucky Supreme Court said here. They said, we are not going to find, this isn't enough because it does not provide a rationale or an explanation for the crime. That is a nexus. That is forbidden by the United States Supreme Court. That was the basis for which the Kentucky Supreme Court denied Benny Hodge relief. And that
here,
is why-
Here, counsel, we're looking to find, I guess in the prejudice arena, we are looking to know, to assess whether the unpresented and the jury was charged, the law requires whether the unpresented mitigation was reasonably likely to tip the scales in light of the entire body of evidence here, right, meeting the aggravated two and his criminal history, none of which you're not quite addressing what I thought was the problem here, which was a choice to say, let's not talk about anything aggravating and hope for the,
okay, so
we thought mercy or you know, would help eventually with the jury.
Okay, so to be clear, to be absolutely crystal clear, there was never a decision made by defense counsel to forego the presentation of mitigation evidence.
The word that we used before you used was agreement.
Right, and there was no agreement to do that.
I thought you just told us there was an agreement. I know I heard you use that word.
Okay. To the extent that there was a quote unquote agreement, that was after trial counsel utterly, completely, and in total failed to present or to be investigate mitigation. So the idea that somehow he made an agreement after, remember, a trial strategy is only reasonable to the extent that the investigation was reasonable or the decision not to investigate is reasonable. And most certainly it was not reasonable not to investigate, and most certainly it was not reasonable to forego a mitigation phase, which is very powerful based on the evidence that came in, because of this fear of aggravating evidence without any investigation beforehand. That is deficient performance. And therefore, that trial strategy, such as it was, which it wasn't a trial strategy, such as it was not a reasonable trial strategy. And therefore, this court cannot decide that it was the presentation or the lack of presentation, utterly lack of mitigation was effective assistance, because it was not. And furthermore, it was prejudicial, because the fact that the jury heard nothing at that time, and if they had heard of his long history of severe, unimaginably severe physical and mental abuse with a direct link to his brain development and how he's able to control his emotions and his anger, there is a far more than a reasonable probability that at least one juror, because remember, it's one juror, a reasonable probability, less than 51% of one juror would have found that his moral culpability was diminished such that they would not sentence him to death. And that is what the Kentucky Supreme Court found. That is contrary to, and it's an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Hodge was not retarded, was he? You're just saying he didn't have a full brain development. Is that the same thing or something?
It is not the same thing. What it did is it impacted the development of his brain such that he was stagnated, his emotional development stagnated at age 7 or 8 years old, so that he has to this day childlike responses to stressors, to negative emotions like anger, to to stress, to fear, that he suffers, you know, for paranoia. And that's the other thing that's important unfortunately, is that despite all this childhood abuse, he was actually removed from the home. But instead of receiving treatment for the abuse that he had, that he received. He was actually brutalized again while he was in the Tennessee juvenile facility, where he was beaten by both the guards and at the behest of the guards by the other inmates in the prison. So his brain was developed such that, or wasn't developed such that he could control his emotions. And in turn, that is something that this court, the United States Supreme Court, has looked at as being powerful mitigating evidence.
Counsel, I have a couple of questions. Well, wasn't what the Kentucky Supreme Court was saying that all may be true, but we don't think it would make a difference to the jury because this wasn't an act of anger or failure to control emotion?
Okay. So, no, I mean, even if it was, it was contrary to, but even if it was, that was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, because there are other cases. And one of an example of that is from this very circuit, the Cawthorn case, where the very, 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 very similar facts of a burglary, except that it was a double murder instead of a single murder. Both of the victims were strangled. And on top of that, something that didn't exist here was that one of the victims was raped repeatedly. And even despite that, this court found that the state court's finding that there was no prejudice was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And if that case was from an objective perspective, which is what the law requires, objectively speaking, was an unreasonable application, then this case where the aggravation was even greater and where the mitigation also is great, if that case was an unreasonable application, then Benny Hodges' case was an unreasonable application.
I didn't get here which case you're citing.
It's for Cawthorn. It was Cawthorn v. Colson.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
One other question about this relates to the other issues. What was the state court decision on the relationship between Kraft, the prosecutor, and Bell, the jury foreman?
They did not make so neither the trial court nor the Kentucky Supreme Court made a ruling regarding the relationship between the foreman of the jury and the Commonwealth attorney, who was the lead prosecutor at the trial. And of course, the evidence presented was that they were good friends. And in fact, they were asked at the time during jury voir dire whether or not anyone knew the prosecutors, and the foreman of the jury remained silent, and the prosecutors themselves, including the Commonwealth attorney, remained silent.
And the evidence that they were good friends came from Judge Collins or from someone?
That is correct. No, nope, it came in through
just from
Judge,
him.
Through Judge Collins. Well, it also came in through the bailiff at the time, Deputy Rogers. But in that, the trial court found that he was not credible.
Rogers, Counsel Rogers, was it Rogers, the transcript of Rogers' testimony that showed that he was contradictory within that testimony, didn't he? He said one thing, and then next thing you know, you read he's saying the opposite. Was he a reliable witness here?
Well, so what happened was, is he had told the story, you know, he had told what happened to the defense investigators, the post-conviction defense investigators, and then he contradicted himself at the time of the hearing. And so then he was impeached through the people he had spoken to, the investigators, you know, at the post-conviction hearing. So that was the inconsistencies were what he had told the investigators versus what he had testified to at the actual hearing. So those were the inconsistencies. Now, that again, the state court found that he wasn't credible, but what's important to note is that the court would, and that, which is what we're looking at the Judge Collins, and the state court made no finding regarding his testimony, including both at the trial and the Kentucky Supreme Court.
I'm sorry, so, what?
That they made no finding that whether he was credible or not. They simply, it appears, missed their missed that aspect of the claim when they were deciding it, because okay. they did not address it.
So your time's up. Just do either of you have a question at this point?
I have one final question. Is Mr. Hodge on a death penalty case incarcerated now, or did that case get set aside? They talked about it during the trial, and he was later convicted, was he not? Robbery, murder.
That was,
is that correct?
Right. That is correct. And that was tried, of course, after the Letcher County case, that this case.
Yeah. Okay. So if he gets something different than a death penalty here, he's still got a death penalty in another case, right?
He does. But it's important to note that the death penalty, one of the aggravators in the other case was this particular case, that he had got that he had received a death sentence. And that was the aggravating evidence, or part of the aggravating evidence in the second death sentence, which he got as a result of the fact that his trial counsel was utterly ineffective at the penalty phase of the trial. And so
nevertheless, somehow that has been affirmed all the way. It's been through the Supreme Court, hasn't it? Affirmed all the way?
Affirmed, yes, but without considering the fact that his trial counsel
So it hasn't been habeas reviewed?
No, it has been habeas reviewed. But again, up to this point, the state court, so this case was behind the other case, but up to this point, the Kentucky Supreme Court refused to, based on this opinion, refused to acknowledge that trial counsel was ineffective in the penalty phase. That, I mean, the reality is they found
it
him-
had been argued though, counsel, this is my point. My question is really, has that been presented to court after court and nevertheless failed to respond?
Not based on that, no. Not based on the fact that the
why not? I mean, it's been all the way. Why wasn't it presented?
Because
I'm just trying to ensure that we aren't awaiting another death penalty, and instead we have this one here. I'm sorry, the time's running.
Okay, so the reason for that is because, again, so it was litigated fully, but at the time, Mr. Hodge or Benny wasn't able to make an argument that the aggravator shouldn't count, because the Kentucky Supreme Court had upheld the opinion, and that opinion I'm talking about is this one right here. So as far as the jury knew when they were deciding that case, he had a prior death sentence and presumed that he had received a fair trial, when in fact he had not. So
okay, I just want to clarify this.
Yes.
He is under a final state sentence and a death penalty. That all appeals have been exhausted. However, the aggravating factor, there was only one aggravating factor in that other case?
I presume it was the robbery and burglary, so two. And it was a double murder, and then it was a burglary in a house. It was a robbery.
Well, I understand you to be saying that the operative aggravating factor was the fact that he was under a death sentence.
That was one of the aggravating evidence that the jury considered, yes.
Okay, so that was one of them. But there were...
I didn't...
Okay.
Yes.
And your argument is that that aggravating factor couldn't be challenged because this case was still in effect, and that if we were to disagree and or agree with you and vacate the death sentence, then presumably that one aggravating factor from the other case would be removed.
No, what it means is that if this court was to grant habeas release as it should in this case, then yes, we would go back and we would challenge the validity of the death sentence from the prior case because it was based at least in part on an aggravator that was invalid. Yes.
It would be a second petition. What would it be? In as much as the other had all the appeals are exhausted.
I'm not sure. It would probably be a second, or it might be a 60B, brought under 60B, but it would certainly be brought in the federal district court. State court, and then in district court, yes.
Well, you're talking about habeas relief here, right?
Right. So for
60B, yes, whatever.
We would seek an opportunity for the state court. Again, so under AEDPA, we allow the state court to make the right decision first. So we would ask the state court, if the state court wanted to grant relief, they could. If they declined to even consider it, then we would proceed back into federal habeas court.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Your time's up. You'll have rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Nolan.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Brett Nolan. I'm here on behalf of the appellee in this matter, the warden, Scott Jordan. Your Honors, I think that the overriding issue that this court needs to focus on in this case is the standard under 2254 D1 and D2. This is an AEDPA case, and because of that, the petitioner faces an incredibly steep hill in order to obtain relief. In the recent case, Taylor v. Simpson, this court said that habeas relief is reserved for only the most extreme malfunctions of the system, and it is not a time for ordinary error correction through appeal. So because of that, the question for this court is not whether the Kentucky Supreme Court got the decision right. It's not whether this panel or a different panel disagrees with the decision that the Kentucky Supreme Court reached. The question is only whether the decision was so far outside the bounds of reason that there could be no fair-minded disagreement about that. What that means when we're talking about the alleged legal errors here is that this court can reverse only if it finds that the Kentucky Supreme Court's decision was so contrary to United States Supreme Court precedent that no fair-minded jurist could agree with it. This is a difficult and deferential standard. And as this court and the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly said, that difficulty is intentional. The petitioner in this case cannot meet his burden under 2254 because the Kentucky Supreme Court applied the correct legal rules, discussed the right facts, and reached a decision that was objectively reasonable.
Basically, what the court was saying is that this crime was so awful that no matter how much abuse and both physical and mental the defendant suffered growing up, and no matter what the impact on his emotional development, no reasonable juror, not even one, could have found that it was an adequate explanation for his willingness to do what he did.
Judge White, I think that's partially correct. The court certainly focused a lot of its attention on how brutal this crime was and weighing that against the mitigation evidence. It also did note other aggravating circumstances, such as his criminal history, which includes the failure of several rehabilitative efforts. And that was also part on the scale. This is not a case in which the petitioner's life history would necessarily, to all reasonable people, sort of only tilt in the petitioner's favor. This is a case where the mitigation evidence that was offered sort of had pros and cons for the petitioner. He did suffer a life of abuse, but that life of abuse also includes a criminal history that started when he was very young, and it seemed to only escalate when he was released from custody. The crimes seemed to have got worse over time. So that was also on the scale. And otherwise, I do agree that the Kentucky Supreme Court's decision essentially was, when you combine sort of the brutal nature of this crime, as well as these other sort of circumstances, aggravating circumstances in his life history, that no reasonable juror would have given a sentence other than death in this case. And that's, I think that's perfectly consistent with United States Supreme Court precedent and what it tells state courts to do. It says to look at all of this evidence and put it on the scale and weigh it out. The petitioner's argument that the Kentucky Supreme Court did something different, applied a different rule, this nexus argument that we were that was being discussed earlier, I think just ignores the majority of the Kentucky Supreme Court's opinion. If you read the opinion, it clearly identifies the Strickland rule and it goes through the steps of weighing the evidence out. There's a detailed discussion of what the mitigation evidence is. There's a discussion of how the different aggravating circumstances weighs against the mitigation evidence. And then the court says, after weighing it all together under this totality of the evidence standard, that it doesn't find that he can meet the Strickland standard. The language that
they, Mr. Nolan, what do you say about the argument that this violates the Supreme Court precedent with respect to drawing a nexus?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any merit to that. If you look at those cases, those lines of cases, those are about not allowing a jury to consider this evidence. Those are not cases about in which you say that the evidence wouldn't have made a difference in this case. Those are cases in which the court is saying that if there's not a nexus between the crime and the mitigation evidence, the evidence is going to be excluded. And that's not what happened here. I think the best evidence of that, Your Honor, is that if you look after the court talks about this sort of virtually no rationale explanation when discussing the PTSD evidence, about three sentences later in the opinion, the court refers back again to how brutal it found this crime to be and how it's weighing it against the mitigation evidence. If the court
brutality, though, Mr. Nolan, I wonder if the focus of this noting the brutality is about the stabbing. In a way, one could figure that someone who'd been brutally abused throughout their life has this explosion of anger, and so the multiple stabbing. I mean, is that the brutality, or is it the whole concocting the crime, breaking in, the father, you know? It, what did they draw the brutality? They just used the phrase, I think.
They refer to the crime as depraved and brutal. You know, they do also refer to the crime as being a cold-blooded and premeditated murder. So I think that it's sort of all of this together, that this is a particularly brutal crime, but the fact that it was also cold-blooded, it was planned out before. This was a crime that involved, you know, entering a house under false pretenses. This wasn't sort of an explosion of rage like you see in other cases. And I think that the Kentucky Supreme Court sort of reasonably considered the fact that sometimes mitigation evidence could explain a crime that's committed in a fit of rage, but that didn't seem to fit the circumstances of this case.
But the problem, I guess, is that you have a cold-blooded, heartless, I mean, you have somebody who just basically plans it, goes in, and, you know, just murders people. And, you know, the jury is like this guy's a monster. Who does that? Why would anybody do that? And then they're told he has a loving family. The inability to understand what it means to kill someone and their family and all the rest, I mean, that requires having some empathy and having some values. And this type of evidence that was excluded explains that. And I just think to say that no reasonable juror would have been swayed is sort of tough to accept.
Your Honor, I agree with the fact that, you know, this mitigation evidence certainly is exactly the kind of mitigation evidence that the United States Supreme Court has said would affect a jury for all the reasons that you've stated. But it's also true that there's not a sort of a per se rule that you can offer this kind of history of abuse and that you automatically meet the requirement of prejudice. That's why Strickland is a weighing test. And in cases like Richter, the court has pointed out that when you have these general rules that require weighing the totality of the evidence, that those rules are very hard to then come in under D1 and show that it was an objectively unreasonable application of that.
Counsel, I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think, you know, you're right, it is a weighing. But, I mean, based on at least my experience with death penalty cases, what you usually have is there was some mitigating evidence, but they, you know, the claim is that counsel was ineffective for not getting, you know, for just doing ABC and not doing XYZ. Here you have absolutely none, and the evidence itself is not, you know, it's not a difference in degree. I mean, it's very substantial evidence. And I've never seen a case where you have nothing versus something heavy and then saying no reasonable juror would have been affected by it. You know, I know you're supposed to be weighing, but there's very little nuance in the weighing, and it seems like it's just completely weighted in one direction.
Your Honor, I think that it's important to remember, though, that this mitigation evidence was not completely in one direction. And that's one of the things that the Kentucky Supreme Court noted, which is that, you know, in a case like Wiggins, which is cited in the petitioner's brief, I believe that that was a case where you had a history of abuse and you had no criminal history. And this is not that kind of case. This is a case where the individual did have a history of abuse, but also had a history of criminal activity, and that criminal activity escalated. It started out small. The individual was in custody and incarcerated at different times, was not rehabilitated. And so every time he was released from custody, he seemed to commit an increasingly more severe crime until this one. And so I don't agree that this is only in sort of one direction. I certainly agree that it's compelling, but I think it's important to point out that the Kentucky Supreme Court agreed with you on that as well and criticized the trial court for not giving this evidence sort of its due. And nevertheless, when looking at the full record in this case, found that it didn't come out in the petitioner's favor. I would point the court to another case. It's not cited in our brief, but it's Abdul Rahman v. Bell. That case is 226 F3rd 696. It's a case from 2000. I believe a pre-EDPA case, and so you don't have the layer of deference on it, but it did a Strickland application. Judge Seiler, I believe that this was one of your opinions, and it was a similar circumstance where the mitigation evidence at trial wasn't there at all, and the mitigation evidence that reappeared later was incredibly significant. I think one of the witnesses in that case said that it was one of the worst cases of abuse in 25 years, something to that effect, but the court nevertheless upheld the Strickland upheld the conviction under Strickland, even without the deferential review of D1. I think what the Kentucky Supreme Court here did was a perfectly reasonable application of Strickland, even if this court were to disagree in its own de novo weighing of this evidence that it should have come out that way.
I have a question about a case that's cited in the briefs, but not really discussed by plaintiff's counsel or petitioner's counsel, and that's the case of Faust against Houck from our circuit in 2011, and it's post Abdul Rahman. Are you familiar with that case?
I believe I'm familiar with it. It was cited in the petitioner's brief. That's a Sixth Circuit case, right?
It's from Ohio, but it's the same sort of situation.
What's the name of the case? Agreement.
It's Faust against Houck. It's 2011 here in the Sixth Circuit. And it said that the state court of appeals was an unreasonable decision and declared that the writ should issue. That bothers me in this case. If you're not familiar with it, well, you can file something later, but anyway.
I get, Your Honor, what I would say is that is a, you know, that's a Sixth Circuit case. And so the question here, yeah, I think, is whether or not under United States Supreme Court precedent, whether this was an unreasonable application of Strickland. So I bring up the Abdul Rahman case only because it's another example of how courts balance these things and how reasonable minds can differ about how these things ultimately get balanced out. And so the question really for us is whether or not any fair-minded jurist could agree with the Kentucky Supreme Court's decision here. I would note as well, Your Honors, that this is not a case in which the state court sort of treated these claims flippantly. These claims were first brought on collateral review to the court, I believe in 2001, and the Kentucky Supreme Court remanded them to allow the petitioner an opportunity to present evidence. There were 4 days of evidentiary hearings in this case. It was only after all of that and the claims were re-presented to the Kentucky Supreme Court that it affirmed. And so I think that that's at least some significant context when thinking about the question for this court, which is whether any fair-minded jurist could agree with what the Kentucky Supreme Court did here. I'd like to turn back really quickly just to address a little bit more about the petitioner's argument on the nexus point here. I think that what the Kentucky Supreme Court did is perfectly sort of a reasonable analysis of what this PTSD, the way this PTSD evidence could have affected the jury. Mr. Burke has pointed out in argument is that some of that evidence shows that he was susceptible to anger and that kind of thing because of his PTSD, which could explain a crime committed in a fit of rage like you see in some cases. And what the Kentucky Supreme Court does here is simply address that aspect of the mitigation argument and conclude that it doesn't really offer a lot of mitigation value in this particular case because this crime was premeditated and cold-blooded, as the court found. But it did not in any way, when it made that ruling, exclude the rest of the mitigation evidence like you have in the cases like Smith v. Texas, where the evidence was considered just irrelevant.
Do you agree that the other case against Hodge is all over, the one involving the double murder and the robbery of the store, I believe it is? Is it all finished or it's still pending?
My understanding is that this court denied the habeas appeal in, I think, 2009. I assume that after that, the United States Supreme Court denied as well. I don't know the further specifics of the timeline of that, but that's my understanding, yes, that sort of the relief that we're at here was denied about 10 years ago, I think.
Let's assume that it is totally exhausted. You heard counsel... Mr. Burke argued that somehow that leaves another opening. Let's forget that for a moment. What effect does that have on our review of the prejudice issue here? Does that affect prejudice? How is someone who is already subject to a death sentence exhausted? How are they prejudiced by a second one?
It is admittedly a little strange. My understanding of the Strickland standard is that it requires courts to review prejudice as if by looking at the evidence that would have been available at the time. And so because that wouldn't have been available at the time.
That's a good answer.
Right. Okay. Your Honors,
tell me about this part that was questioned of the foreman of the jury with the prosecuting attorney, Mr. I forget his name now, but go ahead.
With Mr. Kraft.
Mr. Kraft, that's it.
What was your question, Judge Seiler?
Well, it was brought up in the briefs about the fact that that's grounds for reversal because there was some relationship, business relationship that was not revealed by that juror.
Sure. Your Honor, I would say first, of course, we're under 2254 D2 when we're talking about this, because yes, this is a claim that there was some sort of factual error. And so I think the first thing to address is that this claim was adjudicated on the merits. To understand that, I think it helps to get a little context as to how this claim was presented to the Kentucky Supreme Court. These claims were sort of separated in the petition in federal court as a juror bias claim and a juror misconduct and tampering claim. But in the Kentucky Supreme Court, the claims were all brought as one, and the briefs sort of interchangeably referred to these as juror misconduct or tampering. And so when you read the opinion from the Kentucky Supreme Court, and it says near the end of discussing the section, it says, there is more than the requisite substantial evidence on the record to support the conclusion that Hodge failed to present competent and credible evidence supporting any of his allegations of jury tampering or misconduct. That is a reference to all of the claims that were brought sort of under one umbrella. That's why it's not separated out, but it very clearly says that the court is finding that the evidence, there was no competent or credible evidence to support any of the allegations related to the jury. Yes, Judge White.
I understand on the jury tampering, because you have that alternate juror testifying that there were none of the discussions that Rogers claimed took place. But I mean, the problem I have is that there appears to be credible evidence that there was a pretty close relationship between Kraft and its Banks, yes. Right? Kraft and Banks. There's really no evidence to the contrary, and the court never really addresses it. I know there's this overarching finding that there's no jury tampering, but it doesn't seem to deal with the fact that there was a relationship that wasn't disclosed on voir dire, and it's just sort of hanging out there.
Your Honor, I think that there are a couple things. I would first push back on there being really credible evidence in the record about this. The only evidence is this testimony from the Larry Collins, which is fairly brief. He was asked if he knew if they were friends, and he said that they were good friends. At some point, I think that he said that he thought it was before the trial, but later he said that he couldn't put an exact time on it. And it was really just a few brief statements by this witness who had credibility issues of his own. He was a convicted felon. He had to resign from the bar because of bribery schemes that he was involved in years later with these same individuals. And so the fact that the court did not find that the facts supported this claim, I think that we can conclude that the court did not find that this witness was credible or persuasive on this issue. And Your Honor, I would also point out that the issue we raised in our 28J with a reference to the recent opinion from this court in Taylor v. Simpson, if you look at the briefing in front of the Kentucky Supreme Court, in the response brief, the Commonwealth raised the issue of whether or not Collins's testimony was ever admitted for its substantive value. And in the reply brief, the petitioner said that his testimony was only admitted by avowal. And I think that makes it more reasonable that the Kentucky Supreme Court— It was only admitted by avowal and not for its substantive value. And so I think that makes it it adds to the reasonableness of the Kentucky Supreme Court, who in its opinion acknowledged that Collins testified, but didn't spend any time discussing sort of the substance of that testimony because it was brief. There were questions about his credibility, and it might not have even been competent evidence in the trial court. And so I think that for this court to find by clear and convincing evidence that the failure to rely on Collins's testimony to establish this claim was objectively unreasonable, I think that the evidence just doesn't support that. There were plenty of good reasons in the record to find that Collins was not credible or not necessarily even competent witness.
But the standard of review, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Judge White.
Go ahead.
The standard review is what? Under AEDPA here with respect to this factual matter?
Correct. We're under 2254 D2 because the claim is that the sort of the factual finding that there was no relationship here sufficient to meet the claim of juror bias was an unreasonable finding of fact.
But where was that finding of fact?
I think the finding of fact is when the court says that there is no competent or credible evidence establishing the theories of jury bias or jury tampering or misconduct. I'm not aware, I guess, of, I don't think that there's any authority out there that requires the judges to sort of go through each witness and identify whether that witness was credible or not. I think that the finding that the evidence doesn't support the claim is a finding that witnesses who might have testified to the contrary could have been supportive of of the petitioner, that those witnesses were not deemed credible or persuasive in this case.
And the exact language was jury bias or tampering?
I believe that the jury tampering or misconduct is the language that's used throughout the briefs the most, which is the language the Kentucky Supreme Court used. There was no sort of separate claim in the briefs before the Kentucky Supreme Court for bias. While the briefs do talk briefly about Collins's testimony, I think if you'd review those briefs in front of the Kentucky Supreme Court, that testimony was primarily used as a way to try to corroborate the testimony from Gary Rogers. It was a very different sort of presentation of this claim in front of the Kentucky Supreme Court than what is presented here. It's not to say that it wasn't raised. It just had a very different character when it was in front of the state court, which I think helps explain why the Kentucky Supreme Court dealt with this issue the way that it did. Your Honors, the last thing that I think that I would like to address is just going back to the mitigation evidence. I think that a lot of the cases that are cited for support of the failure for this being an unreasonable application all have materially significant differences in what happened in those cases. The petitioner points to the Porter case, and I think if you look at that case, that was a case in which the United States Supreme Court criticized the state court for saying that mitigation evidence was basically irrelevant and would not in deeming it essentially inconsequential. That's not what happened here. The Kentucky Supreme Court, I think, clearly looked at the mitigation evidence and thought that it was considerable, and it just weighed the evidence against the petitioner in this case. Similarly, I think that the Rompilla case that's cited doesn't offer a lot of guidance here. The United States Supreme Court in Cullen v. Penholster actually stated that Rompilla offers no guidance to courts in understanding how to apply D1 to a Strickland claim. But I think that case is so different from this one. The state court did not even contest the issue of prejudice. And that was a case in which there was testimony that the defendant had the inability to even comprehend the criminality of his conduct. These cases, I don't think, really get the court to a point where it could say that this was an objectively unreasonable application of the Strickland standard.
I have a question. What's the best case that you have from the Supreme Court which would justify our denial of the writ here? Is there one that's pretty close to it where counsel didn't really do much anything and then they looked at the evidence and said, well, it wasn't prejudicial? Is there such a case?
I don't know if there's a United States Supreme Court case that's very close on point here where you have the significant mitigation evidence, but also the aggravating circumstances and that nothing was presented. But I think that fact actually weighs in our favor because the burden is on the petitioner to point to United States Supreme Court precedent that is so close to this case that it could be grounds for finding that it was an unreasonable application. I think that the best way to think about this is to look at the Richter case and how that case talks about how the Strickland standard is a standard of general applicability. And what that means is that it's very hard to find that there was an unreasonable application because the standard is so fact specific. And because the Kentucky Supreme Court here discussed all of the facts and sort of applied them just how Strickland tells the court to, I don't think that there's really any basis to overturn it under D1.
Thank you.
If the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll rest.
Any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Sorry, I was muted. So, Judge Seiler, you mentioned Faust v. Hauck, and I would add, and that is absolutely correct. As far as this, that is one of two that I have pointed out earlier, where this court found that the state court's finding that there was no prejudice was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And in Faust, the Sixth Circuit, this court found that in fact, that the facts of that case were heinous, that the aggravation was, and I think the court used the words, it could not be any worse, and nevertheless found that there was prejudice because of the mitigation that was presented. And I think if you review the case along with that, with the Cawthorn case, that the mitigation presented by Benny in his post-conviction proceedings were, if anything, more compelling, more likely to persuade at least one juror to find that his moral culpability was diminished such not to sentence him to death.
Counsel, which case were you talking about at first?
Faust v. Hauck, which is
okay.
And then the other, the second yes, one is
the one I was questioning you about.
Yes.
That was the case I was asking. Yes.
Well, you were asking opposing counsel about. Yes, sir. So, but there's also a case that, you know, when you're asking about the United States Supreme Court, and that is, I would point the court as far as an unreasonable application to Williams v. Taylor, which of course is a bedrock case, where the United States Supreme Court found that the state court was unreasonable, despite aggravating factors, including not just a double murder, but also that the defendant in that case had assaulted a number of other serious violent assaults against a number of other elderly victims. And in that case, the court found that based on his childhood abuse, but the important thing here is his intellectual disability, that either one was sufficient to find that the state court's finding of no prejudice was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And that is a Supreme Court case. So secondly, the idea that the Kentucky Supreme Court that was simply a weighing, I think requires that there must be independent to look at the individual defendant, but it also needs to consider other cases where people have been, where the aggravating facts have been extreme, which is what happened in this case, both Faust and Cawthorn from the circuit. I want to point out though, that
Counsel, where are you getting that obligation from, that you have to consider not just the evidence, but also other cases and what juries.
Well, I get that from, so the Strickland standard, as we know, is objective. It is not subjective. And in fact, in Williams v. Taylor, the Supreme Court talks about that. So if the ruling there is going to be objective, it cannot be whether or not the lower state court found that it was adequate. In this case, what we know is we have a court with two different very heinous cases where they found that there was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And then we have Benny's case that is, if anything, where the aggravating factors are less and the mitigation testimony is even more compelling. So if we're going to have an objective test, then we need to treat all of those cases similarly. Otherwise, it is not an objective test at all. It becomes a subjective test. And that itself is contrary to Supreme Court precedent. And last but not least, as far as the jury claim, I would urge the court that, in fact, the court summarized its finding and said that they found that the jury tampering was not proven, which is not the same as the juror who lied about knowing the prosecutor. So I think it's clear that the Kentucky Supreme Court did not reach the lying juror, or the juror who refused to acknowledge he was a good friend of the prosecutor. And as a result, there is no AEDPA deference there.
Did the court say jury tampering or misconduct?
It said, what it said was, we do not believe in light of the particularly depraved and, the parties disagree as to whether the presumption of prejudice established, blah, blah, blah. We need not address the parties' arguments because there's been no credible evidence presented to support a conclusion that any jury tampering or misconduct occurred. Hodges 11.2 motion on the grounds of jury tampering was properly denied. So reading it in context, reading the full statement of what the Kentucky Supreme Court said, it's clear that they were considering the Deputy Rogers and all of his testimony as to what happened while the trial was going on, while the deliberations were going on, and not the relationship between the jury foreman and the prosecutor at the trial. And so therefore, 2254 D2 does not apply. It would be de novo review. And the fact that Judge Collins had a prior conviction is hardly telling, given the fact that in this country, there are millions of defendants who are convicted based on the testimony of convicted felons. And the courts routinely affirm those convictions. So the idea that somehow, because he has a prior conviction, that this court should not consider him credible based on his testimony is simply not.
But we were really talking about whether Rogers could be considered credible.
Okay, right. And that does fall under 2254 D2 because the state court did in fact make credibility findings there, but it does not fall under 2254 D2 for purposes of Judge Collins, who also testified. And it's also important to note that in fact it was not, and the counsel for the warden was careful not to say this. It is true that there was a mistake in the reply brief saying that it was a vowel testimony. The reality is it was not a vowel testimony, that it was on the record. There was a vowel testimony, but not regarding the relationship between the prosecutor and the bailiff. That was not by a vowel, that was part of the record. And so it was, while it was a mistake to say that it was by a vowel, the state court obviously has an obligation to actually review the record and not to rely strictly upon the brief that was filed, a reply brief that was filed in state court. And so for all of those reasons, I must stress that Benny Hodge did not receive a fair trial as far as the penalty phase goes. There was a very powerful mitigating evidence that the jury never heard. And beyond the fact that it was an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, the Kentucky Supreme Court's refusal to consider it, even though it was the most severe and unimaginable physical and emotional abuse, establishes that they were unwilling to consider that unless there was a nexus between the crime and the mitigation testimony. And that is definitively contrary to clearly established federal law.
Well, I mean, I know we're going over time, but do you have any language that actually says we will not consider this testimony because there's no connection?
No, but I think, Your Honor, that you have to ask what other childhood abuse testimony or evidence could have been presented that would have allowed the state court, the Kentucky Supreme Court, to consider it? What else, what would it have taken for them to consider it? And the answer is, the only answer is, if it had a nexus to the crimes, because they've already said it was the most, that it was unbelievable and whatever I said before. I mean, they used incredibly strong language. So it can't be any worse. We know it can't be any worse because they said so. So the only other way that the only other thing that they could consider is if there was a nexus. And if there was a net, and if they required that, which they did, in order to consider it, then that's contrary to.
Okay. I just want to say that the problem with that analysis is that you are equating considered it with the outcome. Well, I don't think they ever said we won't consider this, right?
They wouldn't give it effect, which so there's required to both consider and to give effect. They must be willing to give effect.
What give you effect? Okay, all right.
And they would not give effect to it unless it had a connection to the crime, and that is contrary to Supreme Court precedent.
Okay. Do either of you have any questions?
No, thank you.
No.
No. Okay. All right. Thank you both for your excellent arguments. And we will be adjourned. The case will be submitted.